Amen. Thank you very much, Patty. Appreciate that update. It's very, very important for us as a community to keep our focus, to keep our focus from becoming too inwardly centric, and make sure that we're remembering the world that's larger than just our own four walls and our own space here. Well, this morning, before we get started in our teaching of the Word, sorry, I'm just trying to get my act together here, trying to figure out what I'm doing. Not going to happen, so. Yeah, I know it. It's been years, years and years. Is that it? You got anything else? Okay. We're going to play a game of good guy, bad guy. Good guy or bad guy. And I'm going to show you a series of pictures, and what I want to hear from you is what our immediate cultural assumptions are about these people. Don't sit down and try to think through all of the answers that you think that I want to hear or anything like that. Just as you see the person, just immediately what comes to your mind when you see this person. Is this person a good guy or a bad guy or whatever? So we'll start with this person, Mother Teresa. Good guy. One of the good guys out there helping the orphans and the people. Because she's passed on now, but she definitely was making an impact in the world while she was here. Michael Vick. Bad guy. Bad guy. Everybody right away. The little doggies and stuff. Okay. Nelson Mandela. Good guy. Right away, man. We know. We got these. Everybody's got this really good. We know how to do this. Casey Anthony. Questionable. Bad guy. Almost immediately. Do you know that I read something that she's one of the most hated people in the United States today? Could you imagine having that label? That's intense. That is an intense thing. Okay, here's another category. Weird guy. Good guy, bad guy, or weird guy? Weird guy? Is that what I heard? Weird guy, yeah. Weird guy. Okay. Bad guy. Everybody knows that right off the bat. But actually, have you seen Star Wars? Yeah. See, that's the interesting thing. It's a fictitious character, so it's easy enough to go ahead and kind of speculate on this. But it's really interesting that the Darth Vader, you know, he kind of challenges our concepts here. He's a reminder that people and their stories are actually a little bit more complex than our automatic categorization that we come up with for people. But actually, Darth Vader's story, his whole story, and, you know, okay, yeah, I am a nerd and I know this stuff, but his whole story is one of redemption, actually. If you follow the whole epic through, his is a story of being restored, you could say. And yet, because of how he looks, because of what we've known him to be, our immediate gut reaction on that when we see him is bad guy. He's bad guy. He's the epitome of bad guys. He's, for our culture and our time, he's somebody who's, you know, stood out as the bad guy. You know, we do that a lot in life. We categorize a lot in life. And it's not always a bad thing. When we talk about categorizing people, we don't want to, you know, make a blanket statement about that and miss the places where it actually can be effective. Sometimes it's an important aspect of how we cope with or begin to understand another individual. It'll sometimes help us quickly identify a person who in a lot of ways might remain abstract in our thinking. In other words, if I talk about the people that are in the band here, I would categorize them as musicians, right? And we can get that right away. We say, okay, music plays a large part in their lives. It helps to kind of inform us about what their priorities are, what it is their interests have been. So there's nothing inherently wrong with doing something like that, being able to categorize somebody in that sense. But the real problem emerges when we begin to use categorizations to determine our acceptance of another person. And that is a real human tendency, to categorize and label people to make a determination whether or not we will accept them or whether they're worthy or not of our acceptance. And, you know, we'll label people on a large variety of different reasons. It could be based on age, or it could be based on appearance or social respectability, political affiliations or race, sexuality, anything, on and on and on. There's all different kinds of ways in which we label people, and through those labels we make determinations as to whether or not we will accept them And we've all done this. And we've all been subject to this in our lifetime. I don't think that there would be a person here that could say that there wasn't at least one time or another that somebody labeled you and put you into a category somewhere. And whether we're imposing our labels on another human being or whether we ourselves are being labeled, the end result is always the same. Whether we're perpetrating this or the recipient of it, it's dehumanizing. No matter what, it ends up being dehumanizing when we label or we are labeled. And labeling people is never more ugly than when it's couched in religion. Because religious prejudice is an awful thing because it's so often very vehement. In fact, you know, you tie a person's religious convictions with his categorization of people groups, and you've actually got a very nice recipe for war in something like that. And we've certainly seen that in history over and over again. But Jesus shows us another way. Jesus actually comes into town and shows us a love that tears down all of those boundaries and those categorizations and forces us to drop our label makers and back away slowly. Because what Jesus does is come in and throw the doors wide open and make this open invitation, which by and large distresses us but comforts us at the same time. We're going to be reading a story today as we come back in our study in the Gospel of Luke. And if you've got a means of following along with me, if you'll go to Luke chapter 19, please. We're going to be reading a story where a town's got its nice social categories in place and people are neatly defined until Jesus comes along and ruins everything. As we start chapter 19 today, we're going to be reading, we're still reading, actually, a series of vignettes that was started back in an earlier chapter about people who have these encounters with the rabbi and whose lives are changed because of those encounters, some negatively, some positively, along the way. We read about a rich young ruler who came to Jesus and he was so bound up by his idolatry to wealth that he wasn't able to part with his wealth in order to follow Jesus. And we read about how the disciples had a blind spot when it came to suffering, but we also read about a blind man who through his suffering became a vehicle that actually led him to Jesus, led him to this encounter with Christ that changed his life. Now today we're going to read about another man who's an unlikely candidate to be classified as God's special child, but Jesus reveals that this man is one, despite all of our attempts to try to label him differently, and despite all of the attempts of the people in the town where he lived to categorize him in a specific way. Now, the story we're going to read is traditionally considered a tale of repentance, something that's describing for us the change that can take place in a person's life, and I believe that is part of the story, but I do not believe that that is the basic thrust of the story. I don't believe, even though that's part of the action, I don't believe that's the primary message behind it. I really believe that at its heart, it's a revelation of God's amazing love. And it's something that is intended to challenge us about our human tendency to categorize and label people. So if you're there in Luke chapter 19, we're going to start in verse 1. If you're tweeting your thoughts today, please use the EscapePCB hashtag. That would be very cool. So starting in verse 1, it says, he, that is Jesus, entered Jericho and was passing through. And there was a man named Zacchaeus, and he was a chief tax collector and was rich. Now, as we said last time, we're on the final stretch of Luke's travel narrative. We've been following Jesus with a caravan of pilgrims that are going from Galilee to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, and we've been covering this for a long time over several chapters here. Now, we're headed into this final week of Jesus' earthly ministry after he gets to Jerusalem. And last week, Jesus was just entering into the town of Jericho when he stopped by the roadside to heal a blind man. And now he's in the middle of town. So we've got these encounters in succinct succession. So he's going along. He's in the middle of the town now, and the word obviously has spread throughout the town that Jesus is here, this young rabbi, this prophet, this amazing guy, and word even gets out that, hey, he just healed a guy on the outskirts of town. This is crazy. So not only do you have the road choked up with all the pilgrims, that are passing through that town. Anyway, it's said that upwards of or around 2 million people would actually flood Jerusalem during the Passover celebration, which, you know, that's huge by ancient standards. It's incredible. So not only is the road choked with all the pilgrims that are passing through, but now all the locals who've heard that something amazing is going on, somebody who's traveling through, something spectacular is taking place. Well, they're all coming out of their houses too. They want to get in on the action and see what's happening. So all of this is spilling out into the street. And we're introduced to our character here. And Luke actually adds a lot of detail in this, actually more detail than he's given us on any of the previous people that Jesus has encountered. And that tells us then, when we see these extra details, it tells us we need to slow down for a minute and pay attention to this. Let's look at what he's talking about here. Who is this guy? Because right off the bat, we're told the man's name and what his socioeconomic status is. That is, we're told what it is that he does, and we're told that he's affluent in the town where he is. His name is Zacchaeus, or Zacchaeus, and it means literally the righteous one, which, as we're going to see, is you know, his name. That's almost as funny as calling Charlie Sheen the sober one or something. But he's identified not just as a tax collector, but as a chief tax collector, which means that he's in charge of this whole operation. It means he's got little tax collector minions working under him and going out and doing his work. Now, Luke's gospel has always been prone to paint tax collectors in a favorable light. And we've talked about this before, that 2,000 years of separation between ourselves and the prevailing attitudes of the time really soften the impact of this when we read it. He's a tax collector. Yeah, okay, he's a tax collector. But I want to go over again what it meant to the people in Jericho that old Zac was a tax collector, because this was a serious, huge breach culturally with the cultural accepted norms. Obviously nobody likes the IRS or auditors, but that's not what a tax collector was in that society. He was someone who was considered a traitor to his countrymen, somebody who was betraying his racial heritage of Judaism. He was working for Rome, the hated Romans who'd come in and occupied that place. Nobody invited Rome anywhere. Rome came in and took what it wanted and imposed their society on Palestine. And they were also collecting taxes for Herod, this hated, traitorous king who was a puppet king for the Romans. And so he was collecting the monies from the people, the poor people of these lands, people who didn't have money to spare. It wasn't a society like we have today. It didn't have this strange thing called a middle class that is completely new on the historic scene. There was no middle class people who could afford, had a disposable income. You had the very poor and you had the very rich, and this huge gulf between them. And so the poor people were the ones who were being levied with these taxes, and it was all going into the empire's coffers or into Herod's stuff. And to make matters worse, most tax collectors of the time had a set amount that was given to them by Rome that they had to charge for taxes, but they would, in order to make their own money on the thing, pad those numbers. That was acceptable to Rome within reason. Rome had to keep the peace after all. So that was an accepted thing that Rome understood. Yeah, they're going to gouge the people a little bit. That's okay. So trying to find a present day equivalent to this sort of a profession, as we think about that, we'd really actually have to go into the criminal world to find something even close, because this man was an extortioner. He's kind of like Tony Soprano. He's extorting protection money from the poor business owners of the neighborhood. You could kind of look at it that way. I draw a web comic called Rabbi Encounters, and in that comic, I actually did a treatment of this. I'm taking the stories of the people that encountered Jesus in the Gospels, and I put them in a modern-day setting. And when I drew the story of Zac, I styled him as a wise guy who was out collecting money for the mob. That's who he was in that story, and that's about what Zacchaeus would have been. So we got a better picture of him now. We realize, okay, tax collector sounds kind of nice, and it was, you know, one of those things, the Gospels really seemed to like them. But the people of that time did not like these guys. They were criminals to them. And this text tells us that he was rich, so you think about that for a moment. Here he's a guy that's got a house in town that's probably one of the nicest houses in town. And so anytime you went by it, you'd see his ornate gates out there and you'd see people mowing the grass and taking care of his properties. And anytime that he drove by you through the neighborhood, he was always sitting in the back. He had a driver. He'd be in the back of a tricked out Lexus. I mean, that's just the kind of life he was living. And you realized as you'd watch him go by, that's not his money that got him all that stuff. That's not his. That's my neighbor's money. That was my money that put him in that situation. This was all stuff that was stripped off the backs of the poor. He didn't inherit any of this stuff. Small businesses in town were behind in all of their bills because of this man. Farmers weren't able to plant their crops because they didn't have enough money because this man had taken what they had. Children were going to bed hungry in that town because of this man. While he was eating at the finest restaurants and dressing in the finest clothes. Gut reaction right off the bat. Good guy or bad guy? Bad guy. Come on. What? That's not even a question. But as the story goes on, we're going to find that our columns are not, well, while they're easily defined, they're not very easily sustained when Jesus comes on the scene. We get to verse 3. And he was, this is Zacchaeus, was seeking to see who Jesus was. But on account of the crowd, he couldn't because he was small of stature. So he ran on ahead and he climbed up in a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. Okay, so our little criminal, he's heard somehow that Jesus is at the center of all this activity that's going on in town. In my mind, you know, you think Danny DeVito or somebody like that. He's trying to, you know, see. And we realize right off the bat, this is a sudden monkey wrench as we look at this, as we see that he's out trying to get a look at Jesus. It actually ruins our tidy assessment of him right there, right in that little detail there. Because his reaction to hearing that Jesus is the one at the center of all this is that he wants to see Jesus. That doesn't seem like the kind of thing that a criminal mind would want to do, right? I mean, to fit our stereotype, he really should have been trying to avoid Jesus, or at least have been indifferent. Ach, a rabbi, who cares about all that stuff? But the text says that he was seeking Jesus, or it says in there he was to see who Jesus was. That's how it's worded. That is unusual behavior for a crook, isn't it? What do you think it means when it says that he wanted to see who Jesus was? Why would he want to see who Jesus was? What is he talking about in that, do you think? Was he the real deal? Is he the real deal? Is he who everybody says he is? Does that sound about right? No, yeah, okay, that's true. I mean, he was definitely somebody who was ostracized while Jesus is accepted, so he's probably trying to take a look at that. Why is this guy so special? What is it that he's got? It's an interesting thing. And whatever it was, one thing is clear, that he's got questions, and he's seeking those answers, and to seek those answers, he's looking towards the source, and that's Jesus. He's going straight to the person himself, to Jesus. I believe what we learn from this is that our categories for people cannot in any way account for knowing another person's heart. Our categories that we define, our labels that we make for other people, can't know what's really going on deep inside of them. Our neat classification of a person is based on how they look or how they behave, and it's only based on what we're able to outwardly observe. I mean, nobody else has got another means of being able to assess another human being, as far as I know. But we should know by now that there's more to any given individual than just what meets the eye, right? Zach wasn't able to see Jesus right away. The crowd was blocking him from sight. One of them was short. You know, that's what's interesting about this. In the Greek, it's actually a little bit ambiguous. We're not sure if it was Zacchaeus or Jesus that was short. But we'll go with Zacchaeus since that's the most commonly held view. And we would think that for a bad guy, that would be enough to just discourage him. Well, I can't see him. I'm going to head on home and do some more criminal activity. But that wasn't it. He runs on ahead of the crowd. He climbs up in a sycamore tree just so that he can try to get a gander at Jesus from above. And just so you know, climbing trees was not something respectable people did in that culture. I don't even think it is in our culture. You know, you don't put on a really expensive suit and go out and climb a tree. I mean, that's just not, unless you're running from the cops or you're nuts. But here's a guy, he's out in his, he's running. That's another no-no for adults within that culture. So he runs, then he climbs up into this tree. It actually reveals how seriously Zach is taking this quest. reveals that there's something about his heart that we wouldn't have known necessarily just from our original outward observations of him. We have to be so careful to factor in the unknown when we're assessing people. We have to be careful that we don't base our acceptance of people solely on what we're able to observe, because when we prejudge another person and assume we know their story, we have the potential of blocking out those details that could actually reveal what's taking place in their heart if we were willing to observe it. Added to that, if we allow ourselves to be defined by snap judgments from other people, we're always going to find ourselves trying to cater to the demands of popular opinion. We're always going to be working extra hard to make people accept us and make people like us and conforming ourselves to everybody else's expectations. And we realize it's not how much we have or what we look like or how well we perform or do that really defines us. What's happening in our hearts is of paramount importance. It doesn't matter what other people may think about us or what classifications they may put us in. It's what's happening in our heart that really counts, that really makes the difference. That's what God's looking at, and that's where his grace is aimed steadfastly. Okay, the story goes on, verse 5. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and he said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. So he hurried and came down, and he received him joyfully. So here's Zacchaeus. He's up in this tree and he's watching this huge crowd make its way down the street. And finally, what he's been looking for, Jesus there at the center, and everybody's kind of talking to him. In my mind, I would figure that, as it would be in any kind of situation, the disciples are probably having to try to make kind of a ring around him so that people don't just bum rush him, you know, just crush him in the midst of the whole thing. And so there he's able to see him, and he's passing down the road and he's watching him. And as he gets down right beneath him, all of a sudden Jesus stops and looks up. And of course, everybody around him stops and looks up too. And so all of a sudden, here's Zach. Imagine that. To me, that would be a really awkward moment. I would think, here you are, you're up in a tree, your legs are dangling over the edge. You're kind of hoping to be a lurker, somebody who's not observed, just observing it, but not observed yourself. And then all of a sudden, Jesus stops and draws everybody's attention to you. And you're just kind of looking there. It's like, hi. And Jesus' response is kind of interesting to me, because it's almost like he's kind of like, get out of the tree. I got to get over to your house today. I'm coming over there. You know, 10 chapters it's taken Jesus to make this travel narrative. Now all of a sudden he's in a hurry. You know, get down here. We got to go over to your house or whatever. The whole scene is really odd to me. But the fact that Jesus stops everything to single Zach out by name tells us right off the bat that this is a divine appointment, something that God had been leading up to in Zacchaeus's life. And I believe that we learn from this that our categories for people can't account for what God is doing in their lives. Not only do we not know what's happening in somebody else's heart, but we have no idea what God may be up to behind the scenes in working in their lives and leading them in a certain direction. We don't get the impression here that Zach wanted to do anything more than observed. He was a seeker, but he was trying to do so from a distance. But Jesus turns the tables on him and shows that he was seeking Zacchaeus out. In fact, you almost get the impression that Jesus had been seeking Zacchaeus out all along, because he knows his name. He gets right there. He's standing under him in a tree, and he knows him by name. And you have to, we got to wonder about that a little bit, don't we? I mean, did Zacchaeus just have a reputation that everybody knew him? And did he have posters up around town? I don't know. More than likely, at least my belief is that this is one of those cool Jedi Messiah things, that he just knows stuff that he shouldn't know under normal circumstances. But the point is in this, that Jesus saw him, he knew him, and he actually sought him out. We may have written him off. When we think about him and think about what kind of a life he was living and the stuff that he was doing, I mean, we were so offended by his behavior and his lifestyle and his bad choices that we may not have accepted him. We may not have wanted anything to do with him. But that's not what God was doing. That's not what God was doing at all. We have no idea what God's doing in somebody's life, and we need to develop a habit of making room for that unknown in our assessment of people as we know people. Instead of developing our idea of who someone is based on solely on what it is that they've done or are doing or their appearance or any of those criteria, we need to see them through the lens of their potential in Christ. There could be somebody that's really offensive to us. Somebody maybe we work with and we think, oh, I just can't stand this person. I can't believe they behave. I don't even hear all of this. And we've got to stop for a moment and wonder, for a moment at least, what's God up to there though? Think of the potential of this person. Think of the potential that's there if Christ gets a hold of this and makes those changes. And look, I'm not saying that's easy. I'm not, you know, it's easy right now because we're all just sitting around here and having a good time and enjoying ourselves. But it's a little more challenging when we're right in the midst of the situation. But this is what the Word is encouraging us to do. This is what he's encouraging us. It's not easy, but it's what we need to work towards if we're going to follow Jesus's way. If we're going to advance his purposes, his causes in this world. On the other side of that, have you ever felt alone and ostracized because of someone else's label of you? Have you ever felt because of maybe your social status or your appearance that you're insignificant in some way, that you could be lost in the crowd so easily and no one would ever care? Realize this. From this passage, realize this. Jesus knows you. He knows everything about you. He knows your name. He cares about you. He's working towards drawing you deeper into relationship with him. Let's build our identities on that truth, not on the fickle attitudes of the crowds. And okay, well, the scene actually gets people's attention here. Verse 7 says, when they saw it, they all grumbled. He's gone to be the guest of a man who's a sinner. And we say, well, they who? Well, the crowds, most likely is the locals who are there who know who this guy is. They're the ones who had felt the sting of this man's extortion. And now they're looking at Jesus, who they were stoked about just a moment ago. You talk about fickle attitudes of the crowd. Just moments ago, yeah, Jesus, hey, Jesus. What was the problem for them? Why would they have been troubled by Jesus going to this guy's house? Because he was stealing from them on a regular basis? He was a traitor to them. They hated him. He's a known bad guy. We could even factor in the idea that to go into the house of somebody who's openly and known to be unclean makes Jesus the rabbi unclean by associating with him. Even more so in that culture, in the Near Eastern culture to this day, to go and eat with somebody is the sign of acceptance of them. If you eat with somebody else, it means you've accepted them, that you're their friend. And so for all of those things that we said there, he's hated, he's stolen, he's done all this stuff, and Jesus is going to be friends with him. Well, Messiah is supposed to come in and ruin these people. But what Messiah does is come in and ruin our concepts. He comes in and ruins our labels. See, here's the thing. God's love ruins our categories for people because it's accepting. God's love is accepting. Not that Jesus was accepting of bad behavior, but he's accepting of people no matter where they are. We like to get people all cleaned up and respectable before we ever try to present them to God. And yet God never seems to be worried about that. God never seems to be on God's agenda before he reaches out. We always want to try to protect Jesus' reputation because we want to get the riffraff away from him. And Jesus keeps undermining all of our attempts to do that by accepting all of these people that we think are losers and no good. And I got a quote to you from Mike Iaconelli here from Messy Spirituality. I'm pretty sure I've quoted this before, but it's so apropos here. He said, what made people furious was Jesus' irresponsible habit of throwing open the doors of his love to the whosoevers, the just anyones, and the not a chancers like you and me. Nothing makes people in the church more angry than grace. It's ironic. We stumble into a party we weren't invited to and find the uninvited standing at the door making sure no other uninviteds get in. Then a strange phenomenon occurs. As soon as we are included in the party because of Jesus' irresponsible love, we decide to make grace more responsible by becoming self-appointed kingdom monitors guarding the kingdom of God and keeping the riffraff out. God's love ruins our neat little categories for people because it's so accepting of people who just don't have it together. And to that, I just want to collapse into a heap on the floor and say, thank you. Thank you, God, because I sure don't have it together. I surely need that kind of grace at work in my own life. See, not only is this a challenge for us to redefine our own limitations on who we're going to accept, but it reminds us too that God is not waiting for us to get our act together before he loves us. Even while we struggle, we are accepted in the beloved. Even while we struggle with that thing and keep falling back into it, God's love never falters. God accepts us. I'm not saying he accepts sin, but Paul makes a huge distinction there in chapter 7 of Romans. It's not I, but the sin that dwells in me. God accepts us. He loves us. His grace has embraced us just as we are. But that's not all. Picking up in verse 8, it says, "And Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, 'Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I've defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold.' And Jesus said to him, 'Today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost.'" In response to all of this grace that Jesus is obviously showing to Zacchaeus, we don't know exactly how much time passed here, but Zacchaeus makes this pledge that's so urgent that it's stated in the present tense here. In other words, this is not something that I'm going to do later on, but this is what I do from this moment on because I am changed. This is who I am. This is who I am. I'm a person who's giving his stuff away. I'm a person who's restoring anything that I had stolen before. I am living a whole new life because of all of this. And what's interesting is that Jesus never demanded that he do any of this stuff. Jesus never makes that. He did with the rich young ruler. He actually made a greater demand on him. Hey, get rid of everything and follow me. Jesus never said that to Zacchaeus at all. And there's no indication in the text that Zacchaeus is going to quit his job. I mean, he doesn't say that. There's nothing in the text that's going to tell us that Zacchaeus quits his job. And Jesus doesn't even address that. Jesus doesn't say anything like, you can be one of mine as soon as you get rid of that profession. All he points to is that salvation has come. And the word that he uses there, soteria, is a rare word, soteria. It's used most commonly through the New Testament in connection with the Messiah. It's not the most common word for salvation. It's the idea of messianic purposes being fulfilled. That's what Jesus was talking about. In other words, he's saying, I came to this house to fulfill Messiah's purposes because even though this man is ostracized for how he's been living, he's still a child of God, part of God's plan. And I came to go find all those little lostlings out there. I came for this specific reason, to gather up all of those people who don't have it together, to draw them into myself. And Zach's statement in response to that grace shows us something else, that God's love ruins our categories for people because God's love is transforming when it approaches our lives. John wrote in Wonder What, on the Wonder What site, he said, "I see myself in the voices of the crowd. At one point or another in my journey, I have thought that Methodists, liberals, Democrats, seeker-sensitive types, Word of Faithers, Baptists, Catholics, and Gator fans surely couldn't know Jesus." Still not sure about the Gator fans, he says, but I think the answer lies here. Once you see Jesus, you're changed. Zach had a close encounter with the hero king. He really saw him, and old Z was changed. And that's the thing. That's the amazing thing about God's love. Jesus was aware of and accepting of Zach while he was still a crook. While he was still a crook. I mean, as far as anybody could tell, as far as anyone would have known, as far as the text even tells us, Jesus' acceptance and his love came first. In fact, we realize Zach didn't have to go and do something or get better in order for Jesus to love him. Cole pointed that out when he taught. Jesus didn't love him just so that he could get him to do this or that or change that way, but he loved him. And that love then enabled him to rise up, enabled him to transcend that injustice on which he had built his identity so far, that injustice on which he had built his life. He was able to, because of Christ's love, find some new center, new basis for understanding himself. And that's the whole idea. As far as the text tells us, Zach remains in the tax collecting business. I mean, it's a speculation. It's purely a speculation, but there's nothing to tell us that he changed. But because of God's love, he redefines the tax collecting business into something that's wonderful and benevolent in the process. How interesting is that? I mean, he's got all this wealth that he's amassed out of bad behavior. He's now taking that and redistributing it in a whole new way. He's taken that thing that was so horrible, and all of a sudden now it's transformed into something quite benevolent. Jesus didn't put his stamp of approval on sin, but what he did was overpower it and transform it into goodness. That's the amazing, weird thing about God. No one would have expected this. No one would have anticipated that. And I'll tell you, that's something that we can't participate in the lives of other people, as long as we keep people categorized and labeled based on our assessments of them. If we'll remember that we don't know what's going on in someone else's heart, we don't know what God may be up to in their lives. If we remember that God's love is so accepting and the power of his love is able to transform people, we can be part of God's love invading this world through our acceptance and tolerance and love for people around us. We can change this world like Jesus was changing Jericho when he came in, by taking the worst guy in the place and transforming him into somebody else. Simply by accepting him, simply by loving him. Think of what kind of an impact we can make on the world around us simply by loving people, simply by accepting them, humanizing them in our lives. Maybe that's exactly why Jesus shocks the crowd and his own followers that day, by seeking out this crooked man and honoring him and affirming him, naming him a child of God. He's a son of Abraham. He's one of the covenant people. He's a chosen. He's a special person, declaring that he was actually part of Messiah's whole plan. No one saw that coming. But maybe it's to shock us into dropping our label makers and help us be reminded that we're not in control of who it is that God accepts in the first place. An important lesson for us as the church to learn. We're not in control of who it is that God accepts. And maybe it's also to comfort us, to let us know that God's not mad at us. God's not trying to beat us down until we finally conform. God's love is present. And no matter what we've done or what we seem to have become, he loves us and he cares about us. And his grace is the ingredient we need to see our lives transform and to enable us to become the people we were meant to be. To enable us to find our lives and our values and our characters harmonized with who God is. And I think that's an awesome thing. Don't you? Yeah. All right, very cool. Well, if you guys will stand with me, please. I know you're eager to get out in that rain. And so I don't want to keep you any longer than I should. And how do you define should? I don't even know. And that's the problem with talking and then think about what you said after you talk. That is problematic for me. Ronnie's going to be here. He's going to be playing some music and stuff. If you are waiting for the rain to let up, man, come up and talk to us. If you have something you'd like to pray about, we want to pray with you. We would love to see what the Holy Spirit will do in your life, and we anticipate that'll be good things. But we'll speak this blessing on each other. You guys who are parents, please remember to go pick up your kids. They're not going to be releasing those kids until you go and get them. So in deference to those teachers back there, give them a hand and go get your kids right away. But if you want prayer after that, feel free to come on up. But let's speak this blessing on each other. May the peace of the Lord Christ be with you wherever he may send you. May he guide you through the wilderness, protect you through the storm. May he bring you home rejoicing at the wonders he has shown you. May he bring you home rejoicing once again into these doors. Go in peace, you children of God.